Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. She was making that introduction sound so interesting that I was beginning to get interested in wondering what was going to happen. I'm glad to be here, and of course, all alcoholics say that. You're glad to... Glad to be anywhere, you know. You know? But I'm particularly glad to be at this particular roundup. It's a terrific roundup and a wonderful place. And as many of you heard, we had a little trouble getting here. They have a storm in Dallas about every 15 minutes, I think. And a little trouble landing, a little trouble taking off, and all kinds of things. I can give you a long litany of things that went wrong. But really, when we got here, people were talking about the troubles of getting here and that. And as I was saying to somebody earlier today, one of the smartest, cleverest, or most useful things I've heard in AA was somebody told me early on that AA stood for altered attitudes. And essentially, that's there's one main thing about me today that's other than that I'm sober is that I have a different set of attitudes. And I'm thoroughly convinced that it's not what happens to me that matters. It's what I think about what happens to me that matters. And as long as my attitude is right, things go along just, you know, quite the way they're supposed to. And it's been nice to be here. I had a wonderful time. Max and I both have had a wonderful time. We enjoyed meeting, being picked up by Harry and Chuck. And one of the first people I ran into when I got here, going down to the hospitality room, was one of the volunteers in the hospitality room. And it was Dennis, who moved here to West Key West from California 8 days ago. And I thought, how terrific, there he is volunteering to work, and he just got here. And they're here tonight, Dennis and Carol. Where are you, Dennis? There he is, over there. You can tell he's already a local resident by the shirt. Anyway, I'm we're glad to be here and glad to be having a good time and really enjoying it. And I, in fact, I even enjoy being an alcoholic, which is strange in itself because I haven't always been an alcoholic. In fact, I didn't hear the gal say it, but I heard somebody talking about the gal who at an AA podium said that she used to drink for the fun of it. And the drinking got to be so much fun that she got to where she drank because she had to. And she drank because she had to, and the drinking got worse until she finally had to go to AA. And she went to AA because she had to, until she got to where she went out of habit, and now she goes for the fun of it. And and our AA program is pretty much that way. And Max is... Al-Anon program and my AA program, and I go to her meetings and she goes to mine, and we even tend to kind of sponsor each other to a certain extent. And sometimes I won't want to go someplace, and she'll say, "Oh, come on, let's go. People expect us there, so we'll go on to an AA thing or go someplace to do something." I'm always trying to talk her into going to movies. We used to like to go to movies, and back. Many years ago when we were dating, we'd go to movies, and we did enjoy that. Today I can't hardly ever talk her into going to movies. The other day I did. I talked her into seeing, what, Pretty Woman. Do you like that? I sat there thinking, why the hell didn't we go to a meeting tonight? And I could go to a meeting and hear about real life instead of hearing that dime store novel stuff about the Hollywood version of life, you know. And I kind of gotten spoiled on meetings. And we love a meetings. We love the program. In fact, it's like Elsa C. says. Elsa C. says it's like two railroad tracks, separately but together. Max has her program, I have mine. We have all those ties, all those meetings as ties holding us together, going off in the same direction. And you know, it's a nice way to go. I think that there ought to be some limits on her Al-Anon speaking, but no, don't laugh now. You should never laugh at the Al-Anon. You shouldn't. You shouldn't laugh down on them. Our book speaks very kindly of them. It says that they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. Don't laugh. You should never laugh at the Al-Anons. There's some Al-Anons here in the audience. I know. I can feel the vibrations. In fact, where I come from, we always have a show of hands first of the alcoholics. It makes a much better meeting if they're alcoholics. Can we see the hands of all the alcoholics? Will you please raise your hands? Oh, we have a definite quorum. Yeah, we can go. We can go on. I've always been impressed with the number of alcoholics that you find at AA meetings. A lot of them. I'm sure there are Al-Anons here too. Don't be ashamed. Raise your hands. Al-Anons. There's one. Come on. Put your hands up. That's okay. Let's give them a hand. That's enough. The Al-Anons are quickly addicted to any attention they get. Don't laugh at the Al-Anons. Al-Anons are okay. They're okay. I go to Al-Anon meetings once a week. I go to Max's meetings too. In fact, not only do we have AA and Al-Anon, but we have two Aladogs dogs at home. Lily and Sabrina. And we're getting an Ala cat. First and next. And his name is Buster. And they all said to tell you, wish you a happy roundup and wish you well. They don't like it when we come to meetings where we have to fly because they don't get to come with us when we fly. In the car, they go along. They go to all our meetings when we go in the car. In fact, they go to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. They have nicer personalities than a lot of people that are trying to take over. As a matter of fact, in going to meetings, driving to meetings, Max and I will often listen to tapes of meetings on the way to meetings and on the way home from meetings. So a meeting on the way to the meeting and a meeting and a meeting on the way home from the meeting. And we were listening to a tape with his father, Tom W. I don't know if he's been out in this area much, but Tom has really a good sense of humor. It's quite a talk, but he was talking about Hitler, and he was reading about Hitler's life, trying to understand, if any way at all, to understand that man. And he was reading about the one time that Hitler drank, and he said Hitler had written this up, and Hitler had said that he and some other young soldiers had gotten hold of some liquor one night, and they drank it all, and Hitler got drunk, and in the morning, he was disheveled and a mess, and he felt terrible, and he made up his mind he was never going to do that again. Hitler decided he would never, ever drink again, and he never did. Hitler never drank again. And Tom says, and I give you Hitler as an example of an alcoholic who doesn't drink and doesn't go to meetings. Anyhow, as I say, I enjoy the Al-Anons. There are two things about Al-Anons that I really do question, though. One is that I can never understand how the Al-Anons who have been around a while and then decide they're alcoholic and decide when they come to AA that they've taken a step up. If you're new here tonight, this is the bottom of the social barrel. You don't get any lower than AA. You can't step up to AA. this is it. This is the worst it ever gets. And from now on, it does nothing but get better. And but the only other thing I don't have my problem with Al-Anon is that it's just a matter of misunderstanding, but I don't think they appreciate how hard we work to make them what they are today. Yeah. They act like they thought we were having fun all that time. And that's the hardest work I ever did, being a practicing alcoholic and a practicing physician. And I don't, they don't act like they appreciate. I think they ought to appreciate. In fact, I tell Max, I said a lot of times, if it weren't for me, you wouldn't even have Al-Anon. She stands up real tall and says, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't even need Al-Anon. Yeah. And anyhow, I was glad to be an alcoholic, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic, which is strange because I didn't even start out as an alcoholic. And in fact, going all the way back, I wasn't even meant to be an alcoholic. I became an alcoholic by mistake. I had never any plans to be an alcoholic. Nobody had ever suggested I'd be an alcoholic. My mother had never said, why don't you grow up to be, why don't you shoot for the presidency of AA or something like that. No school counselor ever said, what about being an alcoholic? They have a lot of fun. You want to be an alcoholic? Never even occurred to me to be an alcoholic. And I don't even look like an alcoholic. Except sometimes when I'm drinking. I wasn't an alcoholic, and I wouldn't have even come down. I didn't even have to come to alcoholic. I didn't have any drunk driving arrests or any court cards or get well nudged from the judge or any of that stuff. But I didn't have to come. In fact, coming to AA, the only reason I came was getting a pass to go to an AA meeting was the only way I could get a pass to get off the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And that wasn't very funny either. I was there by mistake, and it really wasn't funny at all. I had a brain tumor, and there's nothing funny about a brain tumor. I had a brain tumor, and they missed it. And as a matter of fact, and I was there in the nut ward, and they only missed my brain tumor. But the nut ward is a nutty place. They had a strange theory there. They had a theory that my life would in some way be improved if I learned how to make leather belts. I couldn't understand that philosophy at all. I didn't see how my life would be improved in any capacity for me to learn how to make leather belts. And I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. Well, that wasn't my fault. That's the fault of the occupational therapist, because I've always had a theory, if you don't understand a thing well enough, so you can explain it to me so I understand it, then you don't really understand it as well as you think you do. And she'd already explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And that's a strange thing, too. I started going to these AA meetings, and that somehow that had a tremendous effect on my occupational therapy capabilities. And yet I've never been to any AA function, including this one, where they had any occupational therapy booth, you know. I've been to all kinds. Initially, I wanted to. There are 2 kinds of people in AA. There are those who want the very, very minimum, the least they can get, and still stay sober. And those who want all they can get out of this thing. And I've been both, and wanting all you can get is more fun than just wanting the bare minimum. In fact, I remember driving home one night from Chuck and Elsa C's house, and I remember saying to Max, "Let's be careful. Let's play it cool. Let's be careful. Let's not get caught up in this thing like Chuck and Elsa are. We don't want to have this be our whole lives, for heaven's sake." And yet today it is. And yet, of all the things I've ever been to in AA and Al-Anon, I never have seen an occupational therapy booth. And yet, for some reason, if you're new here tonight, this might be the most practical thing you learn. If you come around to these meetings enough, you can go to a network and you can make the most beautiful pair. I did. I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. A pair of moccasins and a half a wallet. And I love those moccasins. They looked good. They wore good too, and workmanship was terrific. And I used to wear them every chance I got. And when the tongs would break, I'd repair them. In fact, it took 7 years. Wearing them as often as I could before those moccasins wore out to the point where I couldn't repair them anymore. And I felt bad. Not bad enough to go back and make another pair, but. But apparently my dear Alnon wife must have thought maybe I would. And for my 7th AA birthday, she had my moccasins bronze. And I love my bronze moccasins. I just used to keep one at home, one at the office, so I could remember the idea of where they came from, thinking if I remember where they came from, I wouldn't have to go back to make another pair. And I love my moccasins, and I still love them, even though they're not nearly as comfortable as they used to be. I was going to these meetings. In fact, like I said, it wasn't even alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic going to these meetings. I was just going to keep this dumb psychiatrist happy. In fact, I remember sitting there in the nut ward before this AA thing came up, commiserating with myself, with the mistakes and misunderstandings and bad breaks and the things that had gone on, that a nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And I remember this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't understand that my problems were marital problems, walked up and behind me and said, "Would I mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I thought to myself, "My God, Doc, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA?" I didn't even like alcoholics. But I could tell by looking at him that it would make him real happy. I felt a little guilty that I could read him so well, but I could tell by looking at him it would make him very happy. And I don't know if you know or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. I mean, they have a certain amount of control over you. And I said yes, and indeed it did make him happy. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into this room, and he's yelling, "My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic, ha, 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 ha." And I thought, oh, crap, you know. I was embarrassed with the guy. The only thing he had to brag about was the fact that he was an alcoholic. I was a lot more impressed the next day when I found out he was an attorney. But in a loud voice. My God, he had a loud voice. I don't remember a word he said, but he said it real loud. And he kept talking about us drunks and us alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous and all this stuff in a loud voice and yelling and hollering. I thought, "My God, man, why don't you lower your voice? These people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that?" You know. I don't remember anything he said until he ended up and says, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting. I would like to go along." And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go." But I figured he'd go back and squeal to that dumb psychiatrist. And he would have. And they went to the meetings and made the psychiatrist very happy. And in fact, it made the psychiatrist so happy that it was obvious to me. In fact, the psychiatrist now, who had been ignoring me a lot, now he wanted to talk to me. He wanted to know what went on at the meeting, what did they talk about, what did they do, when are we going again, what's the next one like, what's it all about? All these questions. I thought, "My God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist." You know? He's ashamed to go, and he's sending me, you know. I wondered how many meetings I'd have to go to get him sober so I could go home, you know. And you know, the funny part about that is that it's an example of the tremendous power of this program. We laugh and joke about this program, but there's tremendous, just tremendous power in this program, and he's an example of that. He's Dave Geddes is his name. He's in practice on 17th Street in Santa Ana, California. He's not an alcoholic, and way back in his internship, before he even went through his residency and became a psychiatrist, he rotated through psychiatry for 1 month, and during that month, they had him go to two or three AA meetings just to find out what AA was like, on the theory that knowing a little bit about what AA was like would make him a better psychiatrist. And he was so impressed with what he saw at those two or three AA meetings that now today, that's his favorite activity as a psychiatrist, to run around with his butterfly net and capture alcoholics, you know, and send them to AA. You know. And he won't even treat them until he's been sober two or three years. And if they're still flaky enough, why, he'll see what he can do. But he won't try to, he says he won't try to do for them what he knows AA can do better. And interestingly enough, it's a number of years back, I was at a convention of IDAA, International Doctors in Alcoholics Anonymous, a doctor's convention for doctors sober in AA. And we had a panel. There were four doctors on the panel. And three of us had been captured by this one psychiatrist. And the fourth of us had been captured by one of the three of us. And at that time, all four of us were working full-time in the treatment of alcoholism, chemical dependency. So think of the tremendous ripple effect of those two or three meetings that non-alcoholic psychiatrist had attended. Real potent thing. In fact, I get another story about a potent thing. It comes to mind when I say that. Well, my home group is the Wednesday night Laguna Beach speaker meeting. It meets on the corner of Glenirie and St. Anne in Laguna Beach. Short block down the hill on Glenirie is Alpha Beta Supermarket. We celebrate birthdays every Wednesday night. Just a few times back, a young woman got up to get her 8th birthday cake. She said that 8 years ago that night, she was down the block at the Alpha Beta Supermarket and bought a half pint of liquor. When she went to pay for it, she asked if she could use the restroom. In the restroom, she cracked the bottle to drink some of her liquor. When she left the Alpha Beta Supermarket, she started walking up the street past the Laguna Beach Women's Club where our meeting is held. Some of us were out on the street, got to talking to her, invited her into the meeting. 8 years later, she'd never had another drink. AA had literally reached out in the street and grabbed her. To me, that really shows the power of this thing. We got a potent thing going on here. And as a matter of fact, it's so potent it even turned me into an alcoholic. That's true. You laugh, but it's true. I thought you got alcoholism by drinking in bars. It's not true. You get drunk drinking in bars. But you get alcoholism by going to AA meetings. Because I went for 7 months, and I wasn't an alcoholic. And I would go and sit in, but I said I was an alcoholic. They liked that in AA. They really get turned on. Oh, he said he was an alcoholic. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Yeah. God, these people are easily amused, you know. So I said it to make people happy, even though it wasn't true. But that's what I found out. Alcoholism is you don't get it by drinking. It's a virus. It affects your brain, and it goes in through your ears. And you get it from other alcoholics, and If you're not, if you're here tonight and you're not really an alcoholic, or even this weekend, be real careful what you listen to. In fact, be safest if you don't listen at all. Or keep your mind open. Keep your mind wide open so whatever goes in goes right on through. Because otherwise, you're liable to hear something and think, oh my God, I did something like that. Or worse, I think, oh, I didn't do that, but I felt like that. You suppose I might be an alcoholic? Boom, just like that, you're an alcoholic. That's how you get alcoholism. You get it in an instant, just like that. We're all instant alcoholics. And the trouble is, once you get it, you can't get rid of it. You know? I thought I'd get rid of it by giving it to somebody else. Made it worse. The more you give it away, the more you got it. And they keep telling you it's a progressive disease. It is progressive. Whether you drink or not, it's progressive. I mean, because I'm a lot more alcoholic now than I was then. In fact, when I first became alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all. Just a mildly alcoholic. And I was just kind of a mild kind of alcoholic of sorts. You know. In fact, I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't a drunkard. I wasn't a wino, wasn't a lush, certainly wasn't a skid row bum. I had a whole list of things I wasn't, but I was just allergic to alcohol. And in fact, in AA, they tell you have an allergy to buying, compulsion of the mind. Allergy to buying, compulsion of the mind. It's all the time telling you that. You have an allergy to buying, compulsion of the mind. I didn't have any compulsion. If I wanted a drink, I drank it. What would happen if you waited for a compulsion and it didn't show up? You know? But I do react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I do weird and peculiar things when I drink alcohol. In fact, a drink of alcohol makes me thirsty. Social drinkers, when they have one of the thirsty and want a drink, they drink their drink and they're not thirsty. In fact, they may not even finish their drink. They waste it. But every drink I ever took tasted like every other one. It tasted like one more, you know. Alcohol makes me thirsty. And I do weird and peculiar things. Sometimes it affects me oddly. I have no problem with that because every drug I've been around medicines and drugs ever since I was 4 years old. In fact, that's how I became an alcoholic. Come think of it. When I was 4 years old, my father gave up his job as a druggist in Canton, Ohio, and he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio. And I literally grew up in a drugstore. And next door to the drugstore was where Max's grandmother lived. And Max was being raised by her grandmother and two alcoholic uncles and by an aunt who was married to an alcoholic. And her name was Maxine Genslein. And as we were growing up, my family didn't like for me to play with a Genslein girl because there were alcoholism in the family. And they were afraid that if I ever married into the Genslein family, I'd turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right. So, I'm an alcoholic by marriage. I often wondered how I got that. What was I saying? Anybody was listening? But I react peculiarly, child. I was saying that drugs are like that. All drugs are like that. Every drug is the same. Every medication is the same in that everybody responds to it exactly the same, except for those who react different. And there's always somebody who reacts different to any medicine. That's why they're on prescription and that. Even aspirin. Anybody can take aspirin, except people who can't. Anybody can take penicillin. Penicillin is a very safe drug. Take a bucket full of it. You can't hard overdose with penicillin unless you happen to be allergic to it. Used to be gave penicillin by shot. Now they give it by pill. Used to give it by shot. Give somebody a shot of penicillin, shoot them in behind, turn around, lay the syringe down. They drop dead.
Wow, he sure is allergic to that stuff. Wouldn't you think if he couldn't handle it any better than that, he'd leave it alone, you know? All medicines like that. Alcohol is like that. I react to sugar. It affects my voice, for instance. It would affect my tongue or my lips. I would talk slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice. I would reach for something and knock it down, or I would trip when there was nothing to... I'd find myself lying there, looking very serene. I think, get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk. And my body said, what do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down. And I'd lie there thinking, isn't that strange that I can't move? I never heard of anybody ever got paralyzed from the ears down from a few drinks. I must be allergic to this stuff. I'll have to ask somebody about that sometime. I was thinking like of an allergy. I was clear back in medical school. God, that's a long time ago. I was in medical school, and I was thinking I'd ask the professor of allergy about why I got paralyzed from the ears down. But I never asked. I couldn't. You can't ask just anybody about something like that. I mean, I don't know. But I know if it did that to me, I just don't think I'd ever drink it anymore. And I didn't want to know what to do about it. I just wanted to know why it did that to me. And but worrying about why it did that to me was being of scientific bent. It was an interesting scientific problem. It took my mind off my full bladder. There's nothing funny about being paralyzed with a full bladder. A bladder that absolutely refused to remain full, it's very sad to be an alcoholic with a poor bladder capacity, and that's one thing. Many fringe benefits to AA. Many fringe benefits to AA, but sad to say, an increased bladder capacity is not one of them. My bladder capacity for AA coffee is no better than it was for beer. But I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining at all. Because even though my capacity is no better, my aim has improved tremendously. And that's nice. I like that. And Max likes that. So today I got to thinking about why. I thought when you first come to AA, you had to figure out why you drank. In fact, what I decided, once I became an alcoholic, I decided maybe I better quit drinking. Because I noticed in AA, they don't really like for you to drink in AA. They don't tell you that, but you can tell. In fact, they even kind of like to make you think it's okay to drink, but you know that they really don't want. They're really kind of fussy about. In fact, they're kind of fanatical about drinking. They even count one beer, and if you're drunk, they even count a few medicinal pills. Listen to them, you'd have them thinking I was a pill head, I never became a pill head. In fact, I've checked that out with a lot of doctors. You ask any doctor how patients become pill heads, and they'll tell you two things. Always, they always tell you two things. First off, none of their patients ever became pill heads. And the other thing they'll tell you is that any patient who becomes a pill head became a pill head because they abused the pills. They abused the pills. That's the only way you get to be a pill head. According to doctors, you abuse your pills. Now, I don't even know how to abuse a pill. I've always been very respectful with my pills. very tiny little pills. You could tell they were very weak, and they would have a little pocket inside the big pocket, and then you always carry your pills in a little pill pocket. And you can't carry pills just any place. They used to put them over with your change, and it's, people say, "Can I change for a dollar?" And you say, "Yeah," and you go like that. And they say, "Oh, you're carrying them, you're tall and around in the daytime." Yeah. Then you put it over with your keys, and you go to get in your car, and you take your keys out of your pocket, and a quaalude runs down the street, you know. Damn thing always runs faster than you can run, you know. And you can't step on it, or you'll abuse it, you know. So, I was always treated my pills with respect. I never abused a pill in my life, and never even took any pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time. I never took a pill unless I had the symptom, the specific symptom that particular pill would take care of. Yeah, I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. Yeah. Well, I never became a pill head, and I got to thinking about, you know, but maybe I better not drink if I'm going to be one of these AA people, because it seems like in AA there's the winners and there's the whiners, and I wanted to be one of the winner type, and you don't see any winners drinking and taking pills, so I decided I ought to quit. I was afraid to quit drinking, because I've done that many times. I've just quit many times, and every time. I've never, ever quit drinking that I didn't end up later drunk. And I thought, God, this quitting drinking is really hard on my health. You know? And so here I am, I don't want to drink, but I'm afraid to quit, because I'll get drunk. And I didn't know what to do. And back in those days, I wouldn't ask anybody, because that was my feeling was, if you ask somebody a question, it proves you don't know what you're talking about. And so I wouldn't ask anybody. And I got to thinking about some of the dumb things I'd heard in AA. Because you hear a lot of dumb things in AA before you're an alcoholic. I remember a big, healthy, husky guy stood up there and said, "If I don't drink today, I'm a success today." And I thought, oh, my God. Big damn deal. You didn't have a beer today. Yeah. Of course, I was still drinking at the time. They did a lot of dumb things. And then I thought the thing really used to bother me was when they would say, "If you don't take a drink today, you won't get drunk today." Well, now any damn fool knows that, you know. Yeah. For God's sake. Any fool knows that, and you might tell that to dummies from Skid Row or something, but you wouldn't tell a doctor, "You don't take a drink today, you won't get drunk today," you know. But I didn't know what else to do, so I thought, well, I'll try that. I won't tell anybody. I won't tell anybody, but I won't take a drink today and just see what happens. Nothing happened. Yeah. And I thought, well, I'll try it another day. And nothing happened that day. And that's what I've been doing for 22 years. And that, and working the steps, and going to a lot of meetings, and reading the book, and having a sponsor, and all this other stuff. I find it very easy to not take a drink. And I think one of the main reasons why it's easy for me not to take a drink is because I drank many yesterday. I don't drink today. Today's a very important day for me. Today's very important today. Today is the day I don't drink. I never drink on Saturdays. And besides, I'm going to drink tomorrow. I don't think I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. And when tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time, and if it's today, I won't drink today. Yeah. And it seems to work pretty well for me that way. In fact, I don't have any problems today with not drinking. To not drink, it's not a problem for me. I know that drinking is my number one problem, but to not take a drink today is not a problem. It's not even an option. And to not take a pill. It's not an option. Between my will, my life, and my sleep, over the care of God. And if I die from lack of sleep, we all know whose fault it is. It's not an option for me. And getting a divorce is no longer an option. I get sick of talking about divorce. And as a matter of fact, it made it a lot easier to, if you're not going to get a divorce, you're not going to take a drink, you're not going to take a pill, then you have to find ways of becoming comfortable. Because if you're not going to reward yourself with a drink or a pill, or a divorce, why bother to be all upset? And as a matter of speaking of divorce, it's a long time ago that I wasn't going to talk about divorce anymore. Last December, Max didn't tell you this, I don't think, this afternoon, she was talking. Last December, Max and I celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary. like I said, we've been in a relationship of very, very varying degrees of intensity for well over 65 years. As I often say, the young people of today, makes people mad, that's true. The young people of today just don't have what it takes to put together a relationship like Max and I have. Young people of today just don't have it. For one thing, you've got to be very, very old. It's like my friend Angie says, there's only two rules for being an old timer in AA. Just two rules, don't drink and don't die. Anyhow, I don't have a problem with not drinking today. It doesn't even occur to me. It's not an option to drink. And my problems today are all my problems. All my problems today are thinking problems. In fact, I don't even have a problem today. I don't even have a problem today unless I think I do. And I have never, ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. If I think I got a problem, I got a problem. Doesn't matter what you think. And if I don't think I have a problem, I don't have a problem, no matter what you think. In fact, I alone determine the size of my problem. I determine whether or not I have a problem, and I determine the size of my problem. And I mostly have big problems. I don't bother with little problems. It's like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. In fact, I don't even have to work on a problem to make it a big problem. I just think about it. I put energy into whatever I think about. If I think about how good things are, they get gooder. If I think how bad they are, they get badder. If I think how difficult a problem is, it gets more difficult. And I take any little problem and just think about it and watch it grow. Look at that. In fact, I can take a non-problem. Say, hell, that's no problem. I suppose if you thought about it enough, it could be a little bit of a... Pretty soon I think, God, it is kind of a... Pretty soon I think, by God, it's a good thing I'm looking at this. Everybody else is missing it, And in no time, I better go back and eat lunch. I forgot to turn my ticket in. Pretty soon I'm obsessed with my problem. And people can't even help you much with a problem like that. They tell you dumb things. Like they say, well, don't think about it. I don't know how to not think about it, I don't know how to not think about something you're obsessed with.
This is the end of side one. Please.
And you have to be careful with problems. You can't neglect them. You have to stay right there with them. The worst thing I can think about problems is that they have such a high infant mortality. I like problems because they just close out the world. You can just focus in on one little thing. It just simplifies things a lot. You can become obsessed with that one little problem. people can't bother you or anything. But they do, though. They call on the phone with dumb little stupid problems, you know. Anybody bother me with that crappy little problem for when I got this problem? Have you ever had a problem that is such a work of art, something you just delight in it? Such a wonderful thing that you can't go to a meeting that night? Somebody calls, are you going to the meeting tonight? You say, oh, no, I can't go tonight. I got to stay home and work on this problem. You know? you go off to that thing. They're liable to waste your time, get you to stay around afterwards to clean up, talk to somebody, take you to a restaurant, you know, waste your time on this. By the time you get home, that problem's liable to be wilted down to the point where you can't even bring it back, you know. You can't neglect problems at all. You have to stay right there with them. They have a very high mortality, and I love my problems. It just narrows life down. In fact, I remember one night I always thought I would do more with my life if things had turned out different. If my father hadn't bought that drugstore when I was younger, if this had been different, or if that had been different, and I had been the first child instead of the last child, or if Max had been more understanding, more cooperative, or more this, or more that. It's very difficult living with Max. You know, here today, she sounded just terrific and all that stuff, but God, you should have been around before I became an alcoholic. And she drove me to drink for years. And it used to be, I used to think it was kind of pitiful the way my life was. I hadn't done as much with my life as I would have done if I'd had things my way. And I used to call my sponsor. I thought somebody needed to know. I would call my sponsor up to tell him, I thought somebody needed to know what it's like living with Max and know why I haven't done more with my life than I have. And so I would call him up to tell him what she had done or had failed to do. And one day I called him up to tell him something she really horrendous that she had done that I can't recall at the moment. And I had hardly even gotten started telling him about this. And he interrupted me and he says, Why don't you put it out of your mind a couple of days and see what happens? I said, Jack, a couple of days, I'll forget all about it. You know? And that's the way problems are. You can't ignore them. You have to stay there and talk to them. I don't know how you think, but I think by somebody talking. Somebody's talking all the time. And talk. All the time talking in my head. If I'm awake, hell, even if I'm asleep. In fact, I have a little more control sometimes when I'm awake. But my head's going all the time. I used to take drugs and alcohol just to shut those. I had all these people living in my head. See, I shouldn't have said my name is Paul and I'm an alcoholic. I should have said my name is Paul and we are alcoholics. I'm not alone up here, you know. There's a whole bunch of them up there, and they all talk. And they talk to me, and they talk to each other, and they get in fights with me, and they fight with each other, and they chatter away. And one of them's up there saying, say this, say. And chatter, all the time talking. It's a ridiculous conversation. In fact, that's another reason about this coffee. I don't drink caffeine coffee at night. I drink it in the morning, but my God, if I drink caffeine coffee at night, they really get the talk. Finally, my body wants to lie down and go to sleep. My brain says, no, let's lay here and talk about it a while. Or even so, I'll get to sleep and about 2:30, 3 in the morning, I'll say, hey, wake up, we had an emergency meeting, there's a bad deal going on. You know that thing you thought you handled so well today and they were so happy about? Wasn't like that at all, you know. They're really ticked off at you. Wait till morning, you'll find out, you know. And they go, oh, I don't want to listen to that nonsense, and I'll roll over and go back to sleep. And just as I'm about to lose consciousness, I'll think, boy, I'm sure glad I'm not thinking about that anymore. And they say, hey, you know, that's not the only time. You know, about 6 months ago, you did something very, In fact, you've done a lot of dumb things. Let's spend the rest of the night making lists of, make a list of dumb things that you've done. Don't want to write your fourth step, my God, we'll take you here tonight, you know. And talk. And all those people in my head. And they, each personality has his own favorite thing to say. And whoever I listen to, the more I listen to them, the more they move to the front of the room and the louder they talk. And the less I listen to them, the more they move to the back of the room and the quieter they talk, but the less often they talk. I used to try to shut them all up, and I would fight with them that. That gave energy to them. They loved that. They would love that. But now I let them talk, and I said, well, thank you for participating. Now if you'll sit down, you'll sit down. We'll call on somebody else. So the one guy is still there. He's been there all my life, but I don't hear him anymore. The guy that says, no matter what the thing is, it's hot, cold, whatever it is, he'd say, well, I think it's time we all had a drink. You know? And the trouble is, every time he took a drink, we all got drunk. And he moves to the back of the room. But there are all these people. I've had to get to know these people and get friendly with them. And to make friends with all these people. In fact, there's one up there that doesn't care too much for Max. No. No, he never has. You're thinking of marrying her? Yeah. Why would you want to do that? Yeah. And yet, there's one up there who thinks she's absolutely tremendous, absolutely terrific. She says things to me like, doesn't she have a great sense of humor? Isn't she attractive? Aren't you lucky you have her? Isn't it nice that she insisted on going to those AA meetings even now? Have a miserable day. Go to a meeting in the evening. Be a lousy meeting. Nothing really said worth a darn. Yet I go away feeling better. And it's because I've been living in the answer. All day I was living in the problem. And I end up living in the answer at the meeting. And I can just... Anyway, I have a choice. I didn't have those choices when I was drinking and drugging. But I have the choices in the program today. You're talking about talking to all those people in my head. It seems to me that in AA, I kept asking, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to share this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. What are these principles? I think these principles are these steps. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, he didn't want to say these steps again, so he said these principles. And I think the idea is to practice these steps in all our affairs. To me, meaning the practicing them at home. And so I've been practicing or focusing on learning to communicate at home and learning to communicate with my higher power and learning to communicate with all those people in my head. And I've gotten comfortable with people in my head. And he thought, I had to think a few seconds. And he says, well, I guess you have to die sober. And I thought, well, the winner is somebody that dies sober. Sounds nice. I think I'll try to die sober. And after a while, I thought maybe it'd be more fun to try to live sober. And then I got to, sometime later, I got to thinking, maybe what I'd like to do is not just be a winner, but be a successful member of AA. And over the years, I've defined success in various ways to suit myself, not to impress anybody else with, and possibly get out of this program. I want everything. I'll never get it all, but I want as much as I can get in whatever time is allowed me. And one of the things about that is that I want as much as I can get, which means more than just being dry. In fact, I like what Father Barney used to say. The priest used to come down from the state of Washington and put on retreats, and he talked about sobriety being like a baseball diamond. The first base was physical sobriety, second base was mental sobriety, third base was emotional sobriety, and home plate was spiritual sobriety. And I thought, because I didn't choose to go into the nut ward and have him send me to some place to get me sober, and I think most of us somehow have been pushed into even physical sobriety. And I was talking about that one time, and somebody said, well, as a matter of fact, you can't get to first plate, first base, without starting at home plate. So you do have spiritual and physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Anyway, what I've been trying to find is more and more emotional sobriety and spiritual sobriety. I don't know quite what the difference is between emotional sobriety and spiritual sobriety. I just want all I can get of that. And it's been interesting to work on that. What? I said, time to quit? I'll quit soon. I'll quit eventually. What the hell? I'm enjoying myself. The hell with them. I work a selfish program. No, I'm getting along with, the communications thing with the people in my head. I've been getting friendly with them, getting friendly with my defects. I think that's very important. I have two phone lines at home. If I'm anywhere within a few thousand miles, we give out the home phone number. We're in the 7-1 and have a chance. Because I've never found, it's interesting to me that I turned into a mild alcoholic, found out that the things I have to do to keep from drinking are the things I need to do that are the solution to any problem I have. I've never had a problem, nor has anybody ever come to me with a problem such that the answer hasn't been in the steps. And that's a very comforting thing to know that the answer is there in the steps. And I've gotten friendly with all these people in my head. In fact, the seventh step does that. We turn our defects of character over to God. And I don't have to work on them anymore. I turn them over to Him. I become willing to have Him remove them. And I humbly, so you have that big loophole about it might be useful to you or to my fellows. So what I'd like you to do is take it all, but I know how you work on these things. So you take it tonight, sleep on it, and in the morning, you give me the amount of this defect you want me to have. And somehow I'll know that that's some sort of a gift from you. And when I do that, I no longer fight that defect. It's His problem, not mine. And I know I have the amount. I've never done that. I've done that with fear and depression and a number of defects. And I've never done that He's ever removed any defect completely. The compulsion to drink is the one that He's removed the greatest amount. But I know even that's still in the back of the room someplace. But I've never done that. He hasn't removed an awful lot of it. And whatever's left, I can live with and laugh at. Rule 62 is my personal motto, and it's the license plate in my car. Rule 62, don't take yourself so damn seriously. It's in the 12 and 12. In fact, as I was reading this someplace the other day, they were calling defects of character demons. It said, hug your demon. Hug your demon, otherwise it'll bite you in the ass. That was a direct quote. I don't use words like that. You know. Hug your demon. In fact, laugh about it. But I figure when Max and I every morning, we'll do the serenity prayer, a third step prayer, and a seventh step prayer, and read some stuff we read. But by doing those three prayers, we've turned over everything on the outside, everything on the inside. Inside and outside. And I think when we've done that, I've given up my right to criticize, condemn, or complain about anything all that day. And in fact, I tell God that in the morning. I get up before Max does. The whole world gets up before Max does.
Hopefully, yeah.
And I go in and I take care of Lily and Sabrina, and I go to my computer and I type a letter to God. And I know how to get his will for one day. I do automatic typing. And I tell him, I said, you take this day and you make happen this day whatever you want to have happen. You have come into my life wherever you want to have come in. You have them say what you want them to say. You have them do what you want them to do. And whatever happens this day, and whoever comes into my life, whatever they say and do, I'll know that's your will for me today. Now you go have fun today. I'll check with you in the morning. Yeah. And I have never done that. That he's ever taken advantage of it. It's always, nothing has ever happened that day that didn't seem like it was part of a plan. Nothing seems to happen by mistake. And one day at a time. And my relationship with my higher power keeps getting better and better. Relationship with Max keeps getting better and better. I remember Chuck C. used to talk about doing things for free and for fun. Love was doing things for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. Nothing in return. Love was doing things for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. Seems a little harsh to me. But he, and in fact, that's, and I try to make Max a cup of coffee, hot coffee every morning, just to make her feel important. Make her feel important. Love is making the other person feel important. In fact, that's my theory as to what alcoholism is. My own personal feeling. Even if you don't agree with it, don't tell me. My mind's made up. I think an alcoholic is a person who, whether they want to or not, and perhaps even more so if they don't want to, whether they want to or not, an alcoholic generates a great deal of love and lacks the ability to express it. And because it can't express it, it builds up like pressure in a tea kettle. It becomes very uncomfortable. And so they put in chemicals to try to suppress the feeling. And it seems to help, but actually it makes it worse because it makes the communication problem worse. Not only can they not express love, they can't accept love. So that the people who love us can't express their love. And they end up with very similar problem. And the pressure keeps building up and building up, and they can't relieve it. And it comes out, it has to come out, so it comes out in anger, frustration, resentment, hostility, violence, all sorts of negative emotions. What can you do with something like that? Doctors can't help, legal profession can't help, nobody can help that. End up coming to AA and Al-Anon. What do we do with a newcomer? We love the hell out of them. We literally love the hell out of their hellish life. We do make them feel important. We listen to them, just as you're doing now. Notice the silence in this room. That's an act of love. Alcoholics are listening to another alcoholic. An alcoholic is talking, sharing, that's an act of love. The others are listening intently, that's an act of love. So listen, to try, that's communication. To even try to communicate, whether you succeed or not, trying to communicate is an act of love. So we love each other to health. We love the hell out of each other's hellish lives. We make each other feel important. Make each other feel important. And I just must sit down. One of my main things that I came here with was a tremendous amount of guilt. Tremendous amount of guilt. In fact, I was resentful because it seemed to me that for all the guilt I had, I should have had a lot more fun getting here. I couldn't learn to like myself until I got rid of that. And that's one of the things I liked about the steps. The steps do that for me. They help me get rid of all that guilt. In fact, Bob C., been sober forever, used to say that when we do the steps properly, the past loses its power to harm us. When we do the steps properly, the past loses its power to harm us. And I had all this tremendous sense of guilt. I had to separate between actual guilt and sense of guilt. And I treated excessive sense of guilt as a defect of character in the seventh step, in the way that I was telling you. And I get rid of that. I get rid of that sense of guilt. And and it turns out that our book says our past becomes our most prized possession. The thing I was most ashamed of becomes our most prized possession. Isn't that amazing? And the question. You're standing at the pearly gate, wanting in. Whether or not you get in depends on your answer to one question that St. Peter asks. What's the question? I always thought it was going to have to do with sin and guilt. And today I doubt that. It's my own personal feeling. My relationship with my higher power is such that I think that he's going to point out that that's a place of serenity, peace, joy, happiness. I heard somebody say in AA that happiness is the absence of unhappiness. And I thought, well, I'll be damned. But say, heaven's going to be a place of happiness, peace, and joy. And he says, you know how we keep it that way? We keep out the malcontents. We don't let in the whiners, complainers, and fault finders. And the question really is, what was your predominant usual mood while you were down there? Because if you didn't learn how to be comfortable down there, you're not going to learn it up here. And I think that is a lot to do with that. It all happened to me with that thing about acceptance. When I accepted the fact that I was, by mistake or whatever, a mild alcoholic, and I went from, I think what I did is I accepted the challenge of being an alcoholic. I think I accepted the idea that I want to get everything I can out of life in spite of the fact that I can't drink like other people. I accepted the challenge of being an alcoholic, and I went from living in the problem to living in the answer. I went from being a whiner to being a winner. I went from being a fault finder to being one finding the positive side. I went from being a victim. I went from being a victim of life, victim of bad marriage, victim of all these things, to being a hero in my own life story. I began to take a leadership role in my own life at that point. And I think we are all sober today. We are all, anybody sober today, we're all winners. So I'm real pleased. I'm real happy. I'm delighted to be an alcoholic. I'm proud. In fact, I can't say I'm proud to be an alcoholic because I don't know anything to do with that. You might think, well, you did. That's how you got to be an alcoholic. You drank too much. And I don't know that that's true. I think maybe I drank too much because I'm an alcoholic. In fact, I understand alcoholics have a tendency to do that. You know? So I'm neither proud nor ashamed to be an alcoholic, but I'm mighty proud. Mighty proud. Very proud indeed to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's absolutely terrific. I thank God for AA, and I thank AA for my sobriety, and I thank you guys for a wonderful weekend. Thank you very much. Yeah.